We will now convene our first of many sessions for the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and we'd like to change the agenda somewhat and wait for others to be here before we get into some of the business of the day. But we'll begin with Sheila Baker giving us some information orientation.
Okay. In front of you, you should have a packet that starts with the agenda, and then there's different materials in there that we'll be working from as we go through this. Myself and John Britton will be doing probably a lot of the talking during this meeting, contrary to most of the hearings that you will have. But we did want to get the subcommittee oriented as to procedures for those of you that are new, and then to do some budget overview things later in the meeting so that you can get a sense of the budgets that you'll be working with. So behind the agenda, there is a page that's titled Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, Subcommittee Overview Information. And that's where I'll start from. The first pieces are basic logistical kinds of things. The first one being, please be here at 8:30.
Preaching to the choir.
Yes. The chair has indicated that we do want to start these meetings on time. But if you are unable to attend or are going to be late, either let the Representative Richardson know or notify our scheduling clerk in our office, and she'll get the information to us, and the number is there, so 9861830. In terms of the operations of the subcommittee, this subcommittee follows the Joint Committee on Ways and Means rules. You don't have to adopt separate rules. I won't go over all of those because I assume that most of you have already looked at them. There may be a slight change now because of the change in the makeup of the House co-chair and House vice chair, but that won't affect the operations of this subcommittee. Probably the most pertinent piece of information from that for the subcommittee at this point is the quorum and the voting requirements. Because we have 5 Senate members and 3 House members, you need a majority of each House and Senate to establish the quorum and then to report bills out of the subcommittee. So that means 3 Senate members and 2 House members are required for, again, quorum and passing legislation out. Now the important stuff. Starting Monday, they will be providing coffee, 1 carafe for this meeting.
Well,
times are good.
Mr. Chairman.
Times are good. Last meeting we
all these other cheap guys around here who won't even give us coffee. Thank
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator.
I understand Senator Carter's just glee at joy at your generosity, but I did see a cart of scones going into one of the other committee members.
Is he going to add that? You are terrible.
I'd like to respond to that. I understand that it's based on seniority, and on certain committees, those that have been here the longest provide the best form of refreshments, and so maybe we would continue with that.
Yeah, I think we should take a vote.
I take a motion.
And I believe that the Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the senior member of the committee provide the refreshments, both beverage and snacks, for the duration of the session.
Can I second that motion?
No, Mr. Chair. I just want to know, obesity is really a problem.
Senator Carter, I would take a motion to table this.
Thank you, Senator. I'm a representative.
That there's no objection to that, that motion is tabled, or we'll get back to that another time, Senator Weston.
Moving on.
Chair, one other a housekeeping item before we go on too much further. Last session, and I had issued a challenge to all chairs to continue the tradition of working and trying to eliminate acronyms, and wanted to offer you, Rosie, for this committee, if you want to continue that tradition into 05-07.
Senator Winters, I appreciate very much that, and I have Rosie on my desk, and having considered this long and hard and the many things that we need to do here and the maturity of those who have learned these lessons over the last two terms under your good stewardship, I thought that I might retain it as a threat and not necessarily implement it at the beginning. And so I'm going to begin each day with a piece of paper on the dais that will be laid out reminding to identify all acronyms before using them. And if it becomes a problem, then we will raise the ante and bring Rosie to the forefront. Thank you. Other thoughts or items at this time?
Okay, I'll keep working through this list then.
You're really pretty good prop. Yeah. The Senate showed up.
I'm on the second bullet under meeting operations on this page. We do ask that if members of the audience or members of the committee or staff have audible pagers or cell phones or anything else that would conceivably be making noise during the session and being disruptive, that people turn those off. And then just as a matter of information, the microphones in this room are very sensitive, and so it's easy to pick up side conversations unintentionally, so you may want to be aware of that. You will get a daily agenda similar to this one for every day that we will be meeting in subcommittee. That will be here when you come to the meeting. It will identify what we expect to cover that day and who the major presenters will be. A weekly agenda showing the week ahead will be distributed to your offices sometime on Friday. Depending on our workload, it may be Friday morning, it may be later in the afternoon, but we will get you a weekly agenda on Friday. And, of course, the meetings are all scheduled in the formal hearing schedule and on the docket. We do have a requirement that meetings be scheduled 48 hours in advance, and so we will obviously know ahead of time what the agenda will look like, and in a minute we'll cover what we expect in terms of the schedule for the first part of the session. Budget hearings and work session process. In your packet, behind the committee rules, there is a page that shows all the budget bills that have been assigned to this subcommittee and who the legislative fiscal office analyst is for that bill and who the budget and management division analyst is from the Department of Administrative Services. And then our phone numbers are at the bottom of this page. And I would like at this time to be able to introduce the other legislative fiscal office analysts and then the budget and management division analysts to you. I know some of you were introduced in full committee, but I thought it would be useful to focus on the ones that you'll be working with in the subcommittee. So first I'd like to ask Deb Manthe to stand up. She's our legislative fiscal office analyst for some of the smaller agencies that you'll be seeing in the subcommittee, including Board of Medical Examiners, Board of Nursing, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Commission for the Blind, and the Disabilities Commission. And then John Britton, of course, has major assignments in the Department of Human Services, the Health Services Group, and the Senior and People with Disabilities Group, as well as the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And then my assignments include the Children, Adults, and Families budget and the department-wide support services budget, which is the basic administrative and policy functions of the department. I also have the Commission on Children and Families in this program. So if I could get the budget and management division analysts to stand up, please, and I will let them introduce themselves and tell what program areas and budgets that they work with.
You want
to? Would you come up to the mic, please?
There may be thousands of people listening. We can't see.
What happened to the other two?
Or half a dozen.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, my name is Pam Teschner, and I am with the Budget and Management Office. I am the lead in the DHS Human Services. You probably some of you remember Mr. George Naughton, and he was the lead, has been for a number of biennia, and he had health services and seniors, and he recently left and took another position, so I am picking up those areas, so I now have health services and seniors and people with disabilities within DHS. And I'll let Jan Dean introduce herself, but she's picking up some of the assignments that I had. Oh, and in addition to DHS, I also have the Disabilities Commission.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jan Dean, and I do have the Children and Adults and Families Division, as well as department-wide support services in DHS. And then I also have the Insurance Pool Governing Board, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames, and I have the Commission on Children and Families, and I also work on the K-12 budget, which will be next door at the very same time, so I will spend a lot of time running back and forth, possibly.
There are two other analysts that you will see in the subcommittee from Department of Administrative Services working, again, on some of the smaller budgets, but they're not here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have attached for you a copy of the revised Ways and Means presentation guidelines. You may have seen these already. I didn't copy them for the audience because they are available as well on our Legislative Fiscal Office website. But this reflects the new approach that we'll be taking this time through in terms of what gets presented when and what the subcommittee will focus on early as opposed to later, so that the initial agency presentation will cover a high-level program description, talk about why those programs are important, and talk about performance in the programs, agency performance, as well as reviewing their priority lists and then their 10% reduction options that they've been asked to identify. So those presentations will happen over the next 5 or 6 weeks, and we do have a projected schedule for you of those presentations. It's in color because as we're putting these together, we have to manage the schedules of the analysts so that, for example, where I have a agency and another subcommittee, so that I'm not in two places at one time. But it does show you the proposed working schedule for us. Next Monday, we'll start with an informational meeting again to hear what's happening about the comprehensive planning for children and families under Senate Bill 555 from the 1999 session. Then we'll hear from the Commission on Children and Families. Then we expect to get into the Department of Human Services, and that will cover the next month, basically. And then some of the smaller general fund agencies we will hear from. And then the expectation is that the subcommittee will develop priorities, program priorities, based on that information that they've received. And then the rest of the session schedule is blank because at this point we need to see how this is flowing and what happens with the priority process before we start scheduling people back in. But the intention is that those agencies that were in initially to talk about programs and priorities and reduction options will come back with more program detail and more budget detail, and then we will get into the smaller agencies, the other fund agencies that we haven't heard from in this initial round, do some work sessions, perhaps of the smaller agencies and the other fund agencies, run those budgets out, and then do the final determinations for what the subcommittee is doing on the bigger budgets.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
Are we not being scheduled to go into communities for hearings?
Senator Carter, the prior team of co-chairs had discussed that, but there had been no schedule actually presented.
I see.
Now, with recent changes, we're waiting for updated information. But I can mention that I'm going to be discussing with them a number of ways to do that.
Right.
One is that we would like to have, if it's possible, to be arranged, at least two evening meetings where we do it with video mm-hmm. direct wire communications to distant areas, so that constituents could go to a local community college or high school or wherever they could have the capabilities, maybe it's a television station even, and then we would be able to have real-time meetings here with them so that they don't have to bear the cost and the burden, especially those that, because of disabilities, may be able to do it with such a sacrifice.
That's
and they won't have to come all this way.
Absolutely.
And so we're going to see if we can arrange to do that, as well as possibly going out into some of the districts to meet with the people.
Right.
Senator Winters.
In addition to kind of hearing and meeting with citizens in the community, is there any plans to maybe go on some field trips, like State Hospital and some of those institutional things that this body is responsible for, just so that members can get an understanding and a feel of what the dynamics and what services that they provide.
Currently, there are none scheduled, but because of the diverse experience that we bring, we're open for any suggestions to do that which will help us to conduct a business. Other questions or comments at this time?
Okay, before each agency comes forward with their budget, you will get from our office a copy of the agency's presentation materials, the program priority list that they've put together, and the 10% reduction options they've identified. You should have already received a binder for the Commission on Children and Families, who will be up next week. It was delivered to your offices day before yesterday, so that you can get familiar with that information and look it over before the actual hearing time. So the idea is that the agencies will get us those materials at least a week in advance, and that we will get them to you so that you have a chance to look over them and develop questions for the agency when they come before you. When we get into the budgets, there will also be a binder with the governor's budget document in it. We went over that in full committee as to the information that's in there. It is an additional resource for you. Most agencies will not directly work through that. They'll work through their presentation materials, but it is additional information that you can have. And if you have questions about what's in there or how to read an automated report or something, then just let us know and we'll help you walk through it. The other piece of information that you'll have this time, we just got yesterday a copy, and each of you have copies in front of you of the benchmark and performance measure data related to the agencies that will come before this subcommittee. So that most of the information is stuff that you will see in the agency's budget binder or in their presentation materials in terms of their performance measures, and so you'll have a chance to work through that with the agency. But the first few pages do summarize which performance measures from these agencies link to the higher level Oregon benchmarks, which I think is a question that members of this committee have had before, and then also give you an idea of for which benchmark, not only which agencies in this subcommittee have performance measures that relate to those, but which other agencies have performance measures that relate to those. For example, if you go three pages in and there's an Oregon benchmark number 14, workers above poverty, you'll see that the Blind Commission has a performance measure relating to that. The Department of Human Services has performance measures that relate to that. But Employment Department does as well. And Employment Department is not a budget that will be heard in the subcommittee, but it may be useful for you to know to get some additional information if you're interested in that particular benchmark, to look at Employment Department's performance measures as well outside of the context of the budgets that you'll be dealing with. So this information, you each have a binder again. It will stay in this room unless you take it with you, so that it will be available to you at all times.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I should put a plug in for the Oregon Progress Board, because they did collate that information and prepare it and send it over, so so that would be of use to you.
You might mention that they also have on CD all of the data that they received to use when they did their compilation. It's the first time that's ever been available, and those CDs are available to us.
Okay. All of the material that you get, the binders, the presentation information, this performance measures document, you're certainly welcome to take it with you to look at it outside of the hearings, but we do ask that if you take it that you bring it back, because we're not in a place to be making multiple copies of agency presentations, and would hope that you would bring those back with you each day for when that agency comes up for the budget hearing. If you are not in subcommittee on a given day and you leave your binder here, then the committee clerk, who I neglected to introduce earlier, Kat Bell, the committee clerk will put the materials in the binder for you so that you have those available as well. Once we get into work sessions, which is where we actually, our office will make recommendations on the budgets, you will make determinations as far as your budget actions. Once we get into work sessions, we'll go through the general process that's outlined in the guidelines, and I won't go over that now because it will be at least a couple months probably before we get into a work session. But just to let you know the general process, as a result of the decisions that you make, we'll develop proposed amendments to the budget bill for the agency. That will be going to the full committee along with a budget report that the Budget Management Division and our office help prepare. And that documents your recommendations. So the budget bill itself is basically just numbers. The budget report is what explains what's behind the numbers. And those materials will go to the full committee and be acted on by the full committee. And then, of course, when the full committee passes the budget out and it goes to the House and or the Senate floor at the appropriate time, the budget report goes along with that so that all the members know what's included in what the deliberations of the subcommittee were. The budget report may contain budget notes, although the co-chairs have, I don't want to say discouraged budget notes, but they are being very sensitive to the number and content of budget notes this time around. And as always, budget notes have to be approved by the subcommittee chair and then jointly approved by the co-chairs. So the impact of budget notes is if there's some additional direction that you feel you need to give the agency to carry out a part of the budget, not a policy decision outside of a policy bill or something totally unrelated to the budget, but if there's some additional clarification or direction that you feel that the agency needs, then a budget note may be an appropriate way to convey that. We can talk about those more again as we get more into work session and down to the final decisions.
Question on...
Senator Mossad.
Can we go back to this? When it's referring to page, and maybe it says somewhere, is that when it says, take a look at page 3, and under the blind commission, and it says page 18 of what document? It's under agency performance measures. Go to page 3. Right.
Frankly, I will have to get back to you with that information.
Because I looked in the back and it doesn't seem to correlate with the pages on the back, so I was trying.
It may be page 18 of their statewide compilation. But I'll get back to you on that and let the other members of the committee know as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
I think that is, and I noticed if they don't have a check mark on, in terms of whether they're on target or not, if you will recall during the 90s when we were able to help more people get off welfare,
if we are not exposing these people to job opportunity or preparing them for that, that means that in a very short period of time, we'll see our welfare rolls burgeoning again.
Mm-hmm.
And it would appear to me that that would be a very important target for us to have. One of the things that we did do, and maybe it's something that I'm going to be willing to work on, is that we developed skill centers in the state. And in skill centers, I think, I'm don't quote me exactly, but I think there are about 13 skill centers in the state.
I don't know.
It's quite a few anyway. And those centers are not supposed to be charging tuition, mm-hmm. because it's supposed to be community-based.
Mm-hmm.
And if this department was working effectively with skill centers to help develop the social as well as technical skills of people, then this number should be higher. So we should see somewhere along the line where there's communication and collaboration between those two entities if we're going to have people get into the marketplace and develop their skills for greater opportunity in this state, then we should not only have a note in terms of whether they're on target or not, and if they're not, I don't think anybody should be sanctioned, but we should be trying to put those people together more so that we can see more effective means toward economic development and work skill development of those people who are either coming out of prison, or those parents for whom we've kicked off welfare, or for those parents who are on welfare and we're trying to get them to go someplace else. So somewhere along the line, with this collaborative model appears to not be working, and we should be doing something about that.
Well, thank you for those comments. In response to them, it brings up a couple of points. One is that the co-chairs have instructed us that we're in a period of transition,
mm-hmm.
in how we will be funding budgets, and that part of this transition will be an increased focus on where each of those requesting funds for their budget stand in their commitment and success in meeting the target goals,
mm-hmm.
which implies that if they're doing a good job, then they should have greater consideration. If they're not doing so good of a job, they shouldn't be rewarded with a full budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not there is the political will to accomplish and to proceed with that, we'll have to. That's part of our challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Also, on your comment about skills, life skills, and skills for jobs, it reminds me of, we have a minute, it reminds me of the story of this man who was intoxicated, who was searching all around the base of a light post, and somebody came by and says, "What are you looking for?" He says, "My car keys." He said, "Well, where'd you lose them?" He said, "Over there." He says, "Well, why are you looking here?" He says, "Well, the light's better." And the relevance of that is that many times we're tracking things that are easy to track, but if you went to the two most important things to help break out of poverty, it's going to be a good job and life skills.
Right.
Because if a person can't get along or can't balance a checkbook or do the things that help successful people to be successful that a lot of people just take for granted, and if they don't have a job, then it just opens up the doors for all the plethora of other problems that we keep trying to deal with. So we keep dealing with symptoms and starting new programs to deal with these symptoms instead of focusing maybe a little higher at what may be contributing causes. So with that, I certainly think that we need to be watching very closely for every opportunity to assist communities, including the community-based skill centers, to help those that can be helped to be lifted from poverty and not merely determine how we're doing in our institutionalization of poverty. Thank you. Other thoughts or comments this time? If not, we'll continue.
Okay. I do want to put a plug in here, if you haven't already, to read our Legislative Fiscal Office written analysis of the governor's budget. It's a document that was delivered to you. I didn't bring a copy of it with me, but it goes through agency by agency and budget by budget what we think are the meaningful both contextual pieces and then detail pieces for the budget. If you need an additional copy, let me know. It's also available online, so if your staff wants to get into it and look at it, it's available through our publication link on our website.
Mr. Chair? What is the name of it?
It's the analysis of the 2005-07 governor's budget.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's very detailed and has tremendous background. It's very worthwhile.
This is the human. This is the human services section of it. I'll just pass it down.
Mm-hmm. Which I carry with me all the time.
I'm sure you do.
It's right here. What's that binder?
Good chair. Okay, so now we can move on to the other subcommittee work, things that the subcommittee will deal with, as well as the agency budget bills. We expect the Department of Human Services will come in with a budget rebalance plan in April for the current biennium budget. So the 2003-05 budget, the department will come in with a budget rebalance plan, and the subcommittee will need to deal with that. That will be the basis for a later, what we call a reshoot, of the governor's 05-07 budget, so that as we go through the budget discussion, numbers will change, particularly in that budget. But we wanted to make you aware that that rebalance plan would be coming, and that goes as a separate bill with a separate budget report.
Mr. Chair, Sheila may want to explain that that's an ongoing process with this particular agency and its budget.
Yes, the Department of Human Services routinely rebalances its budget because of the size of the budget and the variability of the assumptions on which the budget is built. And generally, every 6 months, they will come into the emergency board, or when the legislature's in session, into session with that budget rebalance plan. And we do an analysis of that and recommendations, the same as that we would with their budget overall. You will also see budget-related fee bills. So the Department of Human Services has one this time, and the Board of Nursing, I believe, has one as well. So those will be considered when we get into the budget work sessions for the agency. Federal grant application requests that during the interim are required to come to the emergency board, come to this subcommittee. Department of Human Services generally will bring some forward sometime during the session. Those are considered, again, we do an analysis of those, make recommendations to you, and then you make recommendations to the full committee on those. And then any substantive legislation with fiscal impact that the co-chair is assigned to this subcommittee, we will also deal with. Generally, that will be towards the latter part of the session, but there may be some earlier on that's making its way through the process. So that sort of gives you the lay of the land in terms of the logistics and what we expect in terms of schedule and items that this subcommittee will deal with. If you have any questions on that, we can talk about them now, or you can come to our office later and we can cover some of that. Otherwise, I'll okay. Turn it back over to the chair.
All right. I would like to have us thank you for the presentation, and we'll have the program area budget overview in just a few minutes. But I'd like to skip back to something that I wanted to do at the very beginning, and that is to just mention from my viewpoint, you know, we are a team with a very weighty responsibility in light of the current financial and fiscal environment which we find ourselves, and the responsibilities to try and organize budgets that will provide for the need of the most needy and to help others to help themselves in a greater capacity, in a greater way. And so it would help me, and I think it would certainly help Representative Hanna as well, if we could spend just a few minutes and get to know each other, because if we're going to be working together, this may not happen again, that we have this opportunity to do this. And what I'd like to know is just, you know, where your district is located, and some, just if you could just tell a little bit about how you see or what you see as your key area, or the couple of things that you feel are going to be of extreme importance during this time as we meet to make decisions to recommend to the full committee on budgeting for the human services area. And so if we could, would you start, Senator Moss Anderson, and, yes. And just let's go through this process?
Well, I'm Senator Lori Moss Anderson. I'm representing Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I've been a nurse for most of my professional life and have been a representative for two sessions, and but always on policy. And I've served on policy committees, health. I am now chair of the Senate Health Policy Committee, and this is the first exposure to the actual Ways and Means process. And I am thrilled that there's now a connect between policy committee and the Ways and Means. And I'm going to find this extremely valuable. And I feel very honored to be on this committee. When I take a look at Representative Gary Hansen and Senator Margaret Carter, Ben Westland, and Jackie Winters, and Alan Bates, they have extreme experience. So I, and then with Sheila and John, and I think we're going to be able to really accomplish a lot. But I have a nursing background, and I think our mission is to serve the vulnerable and those who can least afford to take care of themselves, and that is going to be our mission, and I think that we should keep that in mind.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Senator Jackie Winters, and I represent District 10, which is Salem, Almsville, Turner, Monmouth, and Independence. My background in this building goes back to 1969.
You know, I heard that before. I was very impressed with that.
And prior to 1969, my background was, as far as public service, is 1959 at the Oregon Health, which is now the Oregon Health Science Center, but at that time it was called the Med School University. And but in anyway, I've served in this building as a policymaker in 99 as a representative, and again in 01, and then was elected to the Senate in 03. I've chaired this budget in 01, 03, and 03, 05, the second person in the history of the state that only had the same budget twice. I think it happened sometime in 1944. I was around and involved in the creation of the Department of Human Services back in the 69-70s, was involved and engaged in the development of the first multi-service center in Portland, which was an outgrowth of a project called the Information Center during the Model Cities days, when we actually brought together, and which I'm hoping that we'll be able to accomplish some of that this session, where you're bringing dollars together to impact and to have a greater impact on needs. And I'm particularly thinking about the issue that we face with methamphetamine, our health care issues, and our mental health issues. We were, during those years, when you looked at what went on in Model Cities, was saying that if you're able to bring multiple sources together, they may be over in corrections or they may be here, but we've got a critical mass problem, and we need to begin to pool and balance these. It's no secret in this building my interest is children, and as well as health care, and I think anytime you talk about anything in human services. So we do have some great challenges ahead of us, but I do think that this is a very good committee. You have a wealth of information sitting on this side of the dais. We've been here before. I think you're up for the task.
We're delighted that you're here.
Ben Westland, Senate District 27. I do budgets. I am most interested in integrating the myriad functions of the human services budget to provide better, more comprehensive services to our most frail and vulnerable populations. I particularly concentrate on healthcare delivery systems and how we can better improve one of Oregon's greatest accomplishments and signature creations almost, Oregon Health Plan and our managed care delivery system.
Thank you. Senator Carter.
Margaret Carter, House District, I haven't said that in years. Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. And Representative Hinn and I, first got in the legislature, actually, because of my personal ministry with the poor and through our church community. And so my mission has not changed in that sense that I believe that we can deliver great services in this state to our poor and our most vulnerable people in society. So I've been on this committee since 1989, and have always wanted to look at policies and how we can deliver better services to our community and provided with a high level of excellence in terms of how we pool our dollars. And so that has been important to me, and I'm honored, Mr. Chairman, to serve on this committee with you and look forward to our work together. And because I think that we're working with one of the most vulnerable, one of the most maligned, one of the most damned if you do, damned if you don't agencies in this state. And since 1989, I've seen many, many different things where we don't do enough to look at child care and the number of kids that are killed in this state each year, you know, through child abuse. Either then we do too much, and so it's like the agency never knows. It reminds me of the act of schizophrenia, you know, if you will, that you try to do something right and then look like something goes wrong, then you try to adjust and you get too far on the other side. So I'm hoping that this committee will most of all understand the agency that we're dealing with and try to be as supportive, but at the same time be as focused as we need to be in helping them to be focused as well. I'm glad to serve with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Well, good morning. My name is Bruce Hanna. I'm from House District 7. I represent metropolises such as Elkton, Oak Ridge, Cottage Grove, Sutherland. I have a number of constituents with Roseburg addresses, though I don't serve the city of Roseburg itself. My healthcare experience includes being a past president of Douglas Community Hospital. I currently serve on the board of directors of Advantage Dental Insurance Company, of which I serve on the executive board, and I chair the finance committee there. And probably my greatest passion and the one I get the most joy from serving on is the Community Cancer Center, where I've served on the executive board for a number of years, and I'm the current president. And we are in the process of a major fundraiser to build a new cancer care facility in Roseburg, and I'm most proud of that. I hope to bring those experiences and that of being an employer and health insurance issues to this process, and I'd like to see us efficiently use all the funds that we have available to get the most services possible.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Hansen, I'm state representative from House District 44, which is half of Senator Carter's district. My background professionally, we have a nurse and a doctor serving on this committee, and it's only fair that we also have a plumber. most of my probably direct experience comes from local government service, and I was involved in budgets for 8 years with Metro and Multnomah County before I came to the legislature four terms back. Of Multnomah County, when we were there, had a very comprehensive primary care health delivery system that evolved into Care Oregon, and I was fortunate to be part of that process as the Oregon Health Plan was coming into existence, seeing how it worked from a local government perspective. I think I share the same level of passion that we all do in terms of the importance of this committee, the importance of the services that that we need to budget for Oregonians. The impact that we can have on individual lives is just incredible. And I take that very seriously. And then at the same time, because of the limited resources, we have a real obligation to be very careful not to create unintended problems. We may have to make some very difficult cuts, but it's our job to understand what the impacts of those cuts are. And I don't try not to take myself too seriously, but certainly the job that we do here is incredibly serious, and I'm looking forward to being able to contribute to it.
Thank you. I'm Dennis Richardson. As you know, I represent District 4, which is Southern Oregon, and it's from northwest Medford across the Rogue Valley and takes in the metropolises of Central Point, Gold Hill, Rogue River, Williams, Provost, Murphy, and other large centers of population, and primarily rural area. I have been an attorney for 25 years, started off doing anything. I hung out my own shingle and had more energy than experience, but it made it through that, and then became focused on estate planning and on tax matters, and published some things and was focused there, and then transitioned into as becoming a consumer attorney, primarily doing plaintiff's insurance work. And so with that background, being here, and I look at what we have on this panel, and to me, this is a perfect example of how representative democracy is really supposed to work. I mean, take a look at the geographic, the educational differences, the locational or regional differences that we have, and yet we've all been elected by our constituents to come here and make very difficult decisions, very important decisions that will affect the lives of the entire state. And yet I see many things that are very similar. For instance, I am the blessed father of 9 children. I have a son and 8 daughters. And Senator Carter, I think you also have 9 children. Is that right?
That's right. 7 girls and 2 boys.
7 girls and 2 boys. See, if we'd have continued, we'd have had 2 boys. But my wife said, the next one I have to have. And so we decided maybe we had a limited at 9. We had 8 of our... One was from a prior marriage, and then we had 7 daughters, and we adopted one. We adopted a 10-year-old during the course. And so this was we'll be dealing with budgets, dealing with adoption and foster care. And you know, I was a foster parent, and I understand what it's like to have to wait to get a child who's 10 years old that nobody else wants to adopt. And because of her age and some other circumstances, although she was a wonderful child, she was asked a month after she came into our family what it was like to go from being an only child to one with 7 sisters. And she said, well, what's there not to like about having 7 sisters? And it was a wonderful and interesting experience for our very regimented family to have an outside influence that was unique in its experience, having been to multiple foster homes and been through many experiences in those various circumstances, and what that brought to the mix of our family. And and yet they've all made it, and all of them are married and out of the home except for 1 16-year-old. And so, and I'm grateful for that. And I'm successful in my campaigns because I just call my kids in, and I'm
right.
We've got ourselves. If they could all vote in my district, that's half the job right there.
I've mentioned this to you as well, but now that I know Senator Carter's immediate family, if I treat either of you parent-like, because I am 1 of 7 children, and the youngest. And I have 6 older sisters.
Oh, wow.
So I when you two start talking to me like, mom and dad, I'll understand your ways a little bit, okay?
Well, I was asked, how did you prepare to come here? I said, I had 5 teenage girls at once. I mean, I understand what it's like. Somebody asked me, what do you know about women's issues? I got a wife and 8 daughters. I understand women's issues. But seriously, the mix that we bring here is the way it's supposed to function, because we're to come and apply our common sense, our backgrounds, and our honest passion and interest in what's best for the less fortunate in the state, in a way to deal with a $9.7 billion budget. I mean, that's $9.7 thousand million, which is beyond comprehension if you start trying to place that in what, how many dollars would that go to the moon and back? I mean, all this. But they're real dollars, and they're from real people. And yet we have the challenge to utilize those funds in a way that is responsible, that is sustainable, that will increase, if at all possible, the benefits at a decrease in cost in the most efficient manner of delivery of services to help the most needy and to help all others to help themselves, and not merely continue a perpetuation of poverty where, you know, we can just say, well, you qualify and so congratulations, and you don't qualify and so you're out of luck, as if the government has the right to or the ability to say what poverty really is, because it's different things to different people. But anyway, so we have this challenge and we've all accepted it, and so I'm grateful to work with you, and I'm grateful to be here as we struggle through this very challenging few months that we're going to have together to put together a recommendation for the full Ways and Means Committee to pass. And we will not leave this building until this job is done. I mean, other bills, policy bills, you know, they meet political resistance or whatever happens, and they can be carried over for 2 years. But the funding of our state, and especially the focus that we have on human services, must be taken care of in a responsible manner. Having said that, I'm grateful to be part of it, and for us to be efficient, I would just ask if it's at all possible that we all make this a very high priority, and that at 8:30 we be here and ready to go to work, because we're sending a message of how the government functions to people that are not only here but also those that are watching, and they want to know that they have a government where the people are doing the business, and we all know that things come up and we have to leave and we have to come back, but I just hope that we can try and keep that to a minimum because of the message that it sends to people out there that don't understand why we're leaving. I mean, if they've come all this way and they're going to testify and they see that the poor person testifying only has three or four people in front of them and the others are chatting and going back and forth, the message to them is we don't really care, or it's a done deal. This whole thing is all staged, and that we're really just going to a dog and pony show, which is the opposite of the truth. And so I just ask that we be mindful not only of our needs, but also the weighty matters of the fact that we represent a government to those that are watching us, and these cameras are on, and it's on the internet, and if, you know, and it could be watched by tens of thousands of people, although that probably is not the case, but it could be.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think one of the things that we as Senate members will have to do is try to stagnate what we do, because we double the numbers of committees that you guys have, and from time to time we might have to do that, but we'll always for us to try to make sure that we stagnate and let you know. And I would appreciate it very much that when I have to leave, go to another committee assignment, that you know it and that the people know it, because sometimes they don't know what's going on. And so our committee is overlay sometimes, but we will certainly, I think we will, be very responsible and accountable and let you know when that is going to happen.
Thank you, and that is a factor. I'll try and make sure that is mentioned periodically to the people so they understand that as well.
Right.
I also want to say that my understanding of leadership is that when you are in a position of responsibility, it means a position of additional service.
Right.
And that I would make myself available to assist anyone on this committee in any way that I can.
Thank you.
Because that goes with the additional responsibility. And I also will be contacting each of you for your opinions outside of this meeting, because I have quite an uphill curve, a learning curve, since you come with years of experience and in this process, and I come with years of experience outside the process, but we all come together bringing a unique mix, which will help us do the job better than any of us could do by ourselves. Comments? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on a personal note, I only have one child and couple stepkids, but I still hope to bring the same level of passion to this to these deliberations as my colleagues.
With only one child, we're sure that your passion will still be up to it, but we want to make sure that everyone participates to the fullest. Thank you. Any other thoughts or concerns?
Yeah, I'll leave that one. This, yes. We really forget that many times you have the opportunity to have a former co-chair of Ways and Means here, which gave you a lot of expertise, and then you have a former chair
of this committee. And so
it is wonderful.
I'm sure that you can feel and know that people have your back.
I do know that, and I am grateful for that kind of support.
Mr. Chair, since you're talking about children, and since, you know, children are my heartbeat, and I know that they're yours, and I know that they're also
my extended. Well, everybody tell how many children you have.
I'm not telling.
How many are you admitting?
This is going downhill.
No, he said he wasn't telling. I just wanted to... Senator Winters.
Senator Winters has 4 sons, and in a joint marriage, I have another son and a daughter, and we have 10 grandchildren, and one of my grandchild in Southern California who sat with me on the floor of the House, she's 13, and she'll be going to Europe this year to represent the United States in the People Program in the Europe and France.
That's wonderful.
And so she learned from this building, standing here, sitting on the floor with her grandmother, how important it is to represent this country.
Mm-hmm.
But
thank you. Any time that we have youth that come to a meeting, I would like to take a moment and acknowledge they're here, because the more that we can do to help the next generation understand that this is a participatory government. I mean, look at the number of representatives who are children of representatives. Mm-hmm. And why? I mean, they didn't inherit a certain gene pool. It was that they saw that they could do it.
Right.
And so many people never even would think about it, because that's them, and I could never do that. And yet they need to understand that we need their input and their involvement as they grow older.
But just so you know, I'm the baby of 6.
Well, thank you for letting me know that. And I have 17 grandchildren, 2 or 3 on the way, 2 for sure. And if I ever had to give all the names at one time, I'd be in serious jeopardy, and so I will avoid that question. Any other thoughts before we go back into the business of the day?
Is this when we declare conflict of interest on the section of the budget when we get to birth control?
We didn't have them all at once, so absolutely not. All right.
You know, we've had birth control in this group.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, what we wanted to do next was give you a high-level overview of the program area budgets, and there's 2 pieces of information in your packets. One is this spreadsheet thing. We won't go over it in detail. It just shows you the budgets that you'll be dealing with, where those budgets are or were at various points in time, for starting with the 2001-2003 budget, and then some indication of how they've changed over time. So we will deal with that level of detail more as we get into the individual agencies, but we did want you to see the scope of the agency budgets that you'll be dealing with. And then we have a handout. It's a 2-slide-per-page presentation that John Britton and I will walk you through to, again, give you a context for the budgets you'll be dealing with.
Thank you, Sheila, and Mr. Chair and members. I'll begin this discussion on the other handout that you have with the boxes. The Human Services Program area has a number of agencies that Sheila already mentioned. Department of Human Services is by far the largest. You'll see in a moment how big it really is with respect to the overall program area. We'll be spending most of our time on that department. Its programs are varied and complex, as you'll see as well. State Commission on Children and Families, that will begin next week, as Sheila said, after Monday's meeting, which is on Senate Bill 555, which is about comprehensive county-based and community-based planning for children's services. The Insurance Pool Governing Board, the main program in that agency is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The Commission for the Blind, which is an agency that provides vocational services for persons with blindness. Oregon Disabilities Commission, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and finally the Psychiatric Security Review Board. In addition, Sheila mentioned, and it's important to remember this, we'll also be working on the Board of Nursing budget, the Board of Medical Examiners budget. Both of those are other funded agencies. They have no general fund in them. The DHS rebalance, and we'll be talking about what a rebalance is and what goes into it. Federal grants, and as Sheila said already, other bills as assigned by the co-chairs. The Human Services Agency's budget, as you can see from the graphic, $9.7 billion total funds. And when we use the words total funds, we're generally talking about general fund. We may be talking about lottery funds in the Department of Human Services. There's a small amount, relatively speaking, of lottery funds. Other funds, which come from a variety of sources, including licensing fees, but also, for example, within the Department of Human Services, other state agencies, as well as pharmaceutical rebates, recoveries, and other kinds of collections, as well as federal funds. And when you look at the Human Services program area, you have to pay attention to federal funding sources. It's a huge issue, a lot of money, as you'll see, and something to be paid close attention to. Department of Human Services, as I said, is the largest part of the $9.7 billion total funds budget. It alone is about $9,567 million, 98.2% of the total funds budget, about $2.4 billion general fund out of a program area of $2.5 billion. So again, the largest share of general fund, largest share of total funds. The next slide shows the proportion of the human services overall area as far as different kinds of budget categories: personal services, services and supplies, capital outlay, some debt service, and you can see over here special payments. When we think of personal services, we think generally of staffing costs, both salaries, wages, as well as other payroll expenses, services and supplies, the things that are needed to get the job done, paper, travel, all kinds of things like that. Debt service is pretty clear. You can see there's not a whole lot of debt service relative to the overall budget. And, of course, the largest share, special payments, which are payments, some of which go directly to clients, most of which go on behalf of clients to all kinds of service providers, including hospitals, pharmacies, doctors, long-term care facilities, community colleges, all kinds of expenditures that go to a variety of public, non-for-profit, and private kinds of organizations. And this has obviously a significant implication. You'll see down at the bottom of the next slide that talks about human services program budget drivers are varied and complex. The very last one, politics, which will come as a huge surprise to you. This is one of the budget drivers, and for every special payment that goes out the door, there is someone receiving that special payment. Sometimes they are, as I said, clients. Many times they are providers. And so when we try and make program reductions or propose additional money for this budget, there are lots of people who are interested, some of whom are sitting out in the audience today. And you'll see them in your offices. They will come calling and want to talk to you about this budget. Population characteristics under the budget drivers. Here, Sheila and I are talking about things like age cohorts. How many elderly do we have in this state? How many children do we have in this state? What are the poverty statistics? As the chair mentioned, poverty is a terrible thing, and it leads to all kinds of other problems. These issues are generally associated with each other. We see declines, generally speaking, in person's health status with poverty and so on. So poverty statistics related to jobs and unemployment are critical. They are a critical budget driver. Tobacco use, alcohol and drug abuse, obesity. These are all characteristics of the population, and they tend to drive this particular budget. Next bullet, the economy. This is an agency like other agencies, and I'm thinking, for example, of the Employment Department, where when the economy is good, the demand for services generally is lower. When the economy is poor, the demand for services is higher. And this was one of the toughest things to deal with during our recession, where we had to cut this budget back because of state revenue going down at the very time that there was an increase in the demand for services. I mentioned a moment ago federal funding sources. We've listed federal law, especially Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, can you bring in another dynamic in that? Because Mr. Britton had used the analogy that when the economy is bad, that you will see the statistics, the drivers in this agency, the service needs go up. That is also true. You will find when you have high rates of unemployment and the economy is bad, you will see the stats go up in your correctional system as well.
Thank you. All of which also reflects on the revenues that are available, because when the economy is bad, the services go up, but the revenue source from income taxes goes down. So it is a double problem.
Absolutely right. I mean, it puts the squeeze, and it put the squeeze on the legislature as far as coming up with viable solutions. Again, federal law, especially Medicaid. Medicaid is not the only federal funds source by any means. There's temporary assistance for needy families, and the social services block grant, mental health block grant, alcohol and drug block grants. But the largest source of federal funding for the human services area is Medicaid. And it is not simply the laws that Congress passes. It is also the regulation in terms of administrative law that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, you'll hear that acronym a lot, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, put in place to implement these programs. And when we talk about Medicaid waivers, we're typically talking about a waiver of certain types of Medicaid regulation. In addition, there are court interpretations of both the regulation and Medicaid law, and how America's courts, the judicial system, looks at entitlements under Medicaid is critical in terms of how this budget is developed. And also the flexibility that we have to make changes. That's something that's difficult to do. Healthcare cost inflation and utilization. This is not unique particularly to Medicaid. We've seen healthcare costs go up at a significantly higher rate than general inflation. Part of that is utilization. Part of it is technology, the development of new technology, and the need to pay for it. And the fact that Americans generally like to use health services, especially when they may not necessarily feel the economic crunch to pay for them themselves directly. Huge issue. State human services policy directions. You'll see that a common theme within human services programs has been over the years to move toward more preventive types of programs, with the thought that if you prevent major problems from happening, either through long-term care or allowing or giving people some kind of therapeutic treatment, that you'll avoid costs down the road. However, when it comes to reducing budgets, those are often the very programs that we focus on because the people in them are not as critically or acutely in need. Again, finally, politics, and I'll underscore that again and again.
Yeah, Mr. Britton, I might just mention two of the things you just referred to. The population mix, one area is the age demographics, which are going to have a tremendous impact on Oregon. I mean, our population age is going up anyway, but when you add to that the baby boomer dynamic, our subpopulation, and then you factor in a 12% or more annual increase in the cost of medical care, and that's maybe on average, but I know for employers, you look at your rates for employers, group insurance, it's going up 15 to 30% a year, depending on your group and your mix and your census and all of those other factors. And so you have employers that are, the numbers of employers providing benefits going down, which has a consequence on what we're doing. The cost at being three times the 40-year average for inflation and a population factor, and it means that we have three strikes that that spell disaster in the delivery of services in the decade ahead. And so while we may be working on a budget for the next 2 years, we need to also be looking at a long-term solution to a crisis that's developing, and that we can't just wait and let some other legislature deal with it, because it's not going to be dealt with in one session anyway. But we need to be looking at different models and different ways that we can do things so that we can anticipate what's coming and deal with it early instead of being reactionary at a time of crisis. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next slide, human services budget overall growth has tracked statewide budget growth fairly closely. Human services over the last 10 or so years has risen, these are total funds, about 87%. The statewide total funds budget has risen about 80%. Next slide. Since 2001-03, general fund has grown about 5.2% within the human services area. Total funds is up 7.4%. In other words, we have, as a legislature, attempted to increase some other fund revenue sources. One of them, for example, the tobacco tax. But we have also, as budget analysts, tried to find federal funding sources and, frankly, exploit, and perhaps that's a wrong word, but
utilize.
Use to the maximum degree that we can federal funding sources as well. Department of Human Services. We'll now go briefly through each agency. Has a statutory responsibility for delivery and administration of programs and services for children and families, elderly persons and persons with disabilities, persons who require financial assistance, acute health care, the Oregon Health Plan, and long-term care under Medicaid. Programs for persons with mental illness and persons with developmental disabilities, vocational rehabilitation, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, addiction and chemical dependency, and finally, protection of public health. When you think about it, human services is involved in a vast array of services and affects all of our lives in one way or another. The water we drink, the restaurants we go to, the health facilities that we use, the doctors that we see and their licensing. It's quite remarkable, really, as far as the vast array of different kinds of services that you'll be hearing about in this human services program area. The Department of Human Services has four budget and program clusters. And I should say that Back in 2001, 2003, biennium, and even before, there was a significant reorganization of the Department of Human Services from a collection, and I use that word cautiously, a collection of divisions and offices into more of a tighter-knit department with these different clusters. Initially, there were five clusters. The children, adults, and families cluster of today was divided into two. One known as children, adults, and families, which was comprised of children's welfare and welfare, daycare, and so on, and community human services, which was the field structure. The real thrust behind the reorganization was to try and bring together the diverse field structures of the department into more of a one-stop shopping kind of an area, and acknowledge what at least three of the senators talked about, which was to bring things together and say that typically when a person enters into the Department of Human Services for help or seeks help, they have a variety of needs. And rather than to send them to one office for vocational help and another office for alcohol and drug abuse support, the idea was to pull all of that together into an integrated field structure. And that was really one of the primary motives for the reorganization. And as I said earlier, that those five clusters have been, two of them were combined into what is now known as children, adults, and families. There have also been other refinements to that reorganization as well. Children, adult, and families, health services, this is the health plan, and public health, mental health, seniors and people with disabilities, Medicaid long-term care primarily, Oregon Project Independence, and some direct financial payments that are combined with supplemental security income in that area. And finally, department-wide support services, DWSS, which is the primary administrative branch of the Department of Human Services. And we made a footnote here. Note that the governor's recommended budget may be modified in a spring budget reshoot. Again, a term of art which is associated with a rebalance. And we'll talk about that. But those words, for some of you, have no meaning, and after we're done, you'll understand them more than you ever wanted to. Rebalance, reshoot.
Is that the part where we find out how underestimated his caseloads are for 0507?
That's a prejudicial question, Senator.
There will be a review of caseload numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's kind of like if the numbers weren't kind of on target the first time, we get another look at it in April.
That's essentially it. With that, I'll turn it back to Sheila.
So you fix it.
Yeah. It will be balanced.
It will be balanced.
On page 6, then, in this handout, we have three slides that relate to children, adults, and families. The first slide shows the major programs and services in that particular cluster, the Department of Human Services. It includes what they call self-sufficiency programs, including food stamps, temporary assistance to needy families. The common acronym is TANF, employment-related daycare, and then the jobs program and support services. It also includes child welfare, from child protective services through substitute care such as foster care or residential treatment, and then adoptions and adoptions assistance. It includes the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and then, as John mentioned earlier, the field staff who provide the program support or deliver the services in those areas are also now budgeted in the children, adults, and families cluster. The next slide just very high level highlights of the budget. It's $2.2 billion total funds $413 million general fund. The reason that it's proportionately such a small amount of general fund is that the TANF program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, is federal funds, as is most of the employment-related daycare. So the TANF is a federal block grant. It, prior to 1996, was a matching grant, state funds with federal matching funds, but now it's a federal block grant. And so you have a lot of other and federal funds in this budget. We wanted to highlight what was in the governor's budget in terms of changes to what we would have otherwise expected to see in 2005-07. And I've listed there some of the more significant actions. It affects the employment-related daycare program, the jobs program, the temporary assistance to needy families program, the prevention programs on abstinence education and community safety net, child welfare system of care funds, special rates that are paid for difficult to serve foster children or foster children with special needs, domestic violence program funding, basic rehabilitation services, the cost of living adjustment for clients and providers, and then caseload growth staffing. In fact, there is no caseload growth staffing in the budget, and there are further reductions to staffing. And we will talk about all those in detail at a later point in this subcommittee, but we did want to highlight those for you. So when you get questions, you'll know what place in the budget they come from.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Sheila. Sheila, now, on this slide, is this you and John's recommendation, or is this the governor's?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carter, these are just a description of what's in or out of the governor's budget.
Okay.
We are not to a point yet where we have recommendations.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Wessler.
Quick question. Sheila, do we still, I know we kind of combined Jobs and Jobs Plus, do we still retain any vestiges of Jobs Plus in this hybrid we now call Jobs, or is that just a straightforward federal job?
Mr. Chair and Senator Westland, there is no specific set-aside of funding for Jobs Plus, but the agency does have the flexibility to where it makes sense to use some of their jobs money for particular clients, and I think we will hear from them as they discuss their program about how that's coming out. There was a budget note to that effect in the last budget report. Okay, at the top of page 7, then, in addition to the budget and policy issues that I've outlined already, there are issues that will or could affect this budget, including the federal reauthorization of the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family Program. The actual program itself expired in the fall of 2002 and has been operating under federal continuing reauthorization since that time, and there will be another reauthorization necessary this spring. The issues here are if it's a temporary reauthorization of current program, that's one thing, and that's frankly what the budget is anticipating. It's built on current program. But if there's a permanent reauthorization with more or different requirements, then that could have a budget impact. Particularly in the sense of who's required to participate in employment activities or educational activities and what qualifies in terms of the new requirements and any kind of credits that states may be allowed for reducing caseloads over time. Right now, there are certain parameters built into the program, and depending on, again, on the extent and nature of those changes, if there are any, that could affect the budget. There is a maintenance of effort requirement associated with the TANF block grant, so that Oregon is required to spend a certain amount of funding every biennium to continue to receive that block grant. Thus far, we have met those requirements. The governor's budget would continue to meet those requirements. We look at that periodically, and we will be reviewing that again for this biennium, the 2003-05 budget, at the rebalance to make sure that those requirements are being met, and also then to see what the budget proposal for 2005-07, that it complies with those requirements. The downside, of course, of not meeting the requirement is that you would have some kind of penalty, or ultimately could end up not getting your federal TANF funding entirely. And then the other issue that I've highlighted there is in the Child Protective Services area. There have been some hearings already in the substantive committees to talk about these issues, and although the budget has limited changes in that area, that's something that it's an area that will be of interest to the subcommittee, I'm sure, as we move along.
Before I continue with health services, I want to underscore a little bit of what Sheila said. There is a difference, a distinction between what is known as maintenance of effort and a match system. Mm-hmm. Some federal programs require a maintenance of effort, which, as Sheila said, temporary assistance for needy families requires that a certain level of state expenditures, and there are a variety of expenditures that qualify as maintenance of effort, continue. Now, the purpose behind a maintenance of effort is to make sure, as the phrase says, that the state maintains its commitment to a particular kind of program, even though the federal government may be contributing federal funds. As Sheila said, on TANF, this was a matching program, Assistance for Dependent Children, ADC, and it was converted into a maintenance of effort kind of program. But the purpose behind a maintenance of effort is to make sure that a state keeps up its side of the bargain, if you will. A match program is like Medicaid, where we put up a dollar, for example, of general fund, and receive approximately $1.50 in terms of Medicaid support. And those dollars under Medicaid typically are, in theory, unlimited. For every dollar you put in, you get another $1.50. So there's a distinction between maintenance of effort and match that's important. And some programs actually have both requirements, both the maintenance of effort requirement and a matching requirement.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
John, can you tell me if in the maintenance of effort area, are there goals and requirements on the part of the state and its effectiveness in working with children, where so many caseworkers are required, and the ratio between the numbers of people that each caseworker serve? And, Mr. Chairman, I'm asking that question because you've seen what has happened in our state in the last month. And I think it's one of those, if you'll excuse the language, I think it's the distinction between damned if you, damned if you don't. We don't have enough money to have the right number of caseworkers in terms of the ratio requirement. And if we were to get that, then we wouldn't have enough money to deal with the program side of it. Are there goals within this framework for that to happen? Or should I be asking Sheila that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think that the basic answer is no, the maintenance of effort requirement doesn't apply to child welfare staffing. That said, there are some TANF funds that are used to support some child protective or child welfare services, but for the most part, that's funded with Title 4E foster care and adoption assistance, and that's a matching fund set up, but there are no federal requirements in terms of staffing levels.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would like if we could visit this issue as an issue of one where we try to help the department do what they need to do in order to protect our children, which are our most vulnerable, and hopefully that we wouldn't be viewed as Florida or Mississippi, where kids have not had visits in all the time they've been in a home, and so many more kids were being murdered as a result of a lack of care. And it would appear to me that this committee would certainly be working to that end, so that Oregon does not receive the kind of notoriety that some of our other southern states have received in terms of our lack of attention to our children and the high numbers of death that result, and as a result of malnutrition and outright child abuse.
We'll add that to our agenda for the day when we actually are having those hearings.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I can just add something, as I indicated, there are no specific federal requirements for staffing levels. There are performance outcomes that the department will talk about that are federally required and monitored, mm-hmm. and they will be able to respond to those issues, I'm sure. Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a little historic perspective behind the whole maintenance of effort issue federally. At one time in history, there was a lot of block grant funding, and states, rather than using some of those dollars for what the original was intended to be, used them for other purposes. And so to combat that, the federal government, when they came out, says you must, you know, not take these dollars that we intended, and you must maintain, you know, what you had started with in the beginning. You can't take away. And that's basically what had happened through history. So it's a way of trying to prevent states from utilizing federal dollars for other than what the intended purpose, even though they give you a block of dollars with certain parameters. It's so that we can't get so creative that we use them someplace else.
Thank you so much.
Is shift the word?
I'll continue with health services at the bottom of page 7. As I said earlier, three main programs within health services, the health services cluster, and this is the largest cluster within DHS in terms of its budget. First of all, the Oregon Health Plan and the Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as CHIP. Mental Health and Addiction Services, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, OMHAS. And you'll hear again over and over and over acronyms, so we'll try and be clear on what they mean. This includes funding for the Oregon State Hospital and community-based programs for persons with mental illness. And finally, public health. In terms of special payments, not a huge amount of general fund, approximately $15 to $16 million of general fund, federal funds, but 575 or so FTE working in public health. So those are the three main areas within health services. The largest within there is the Oregon Health Plan. Health services, as I said, the largest cluster, $4.8 billion of total funds, almost half of the department's budget, $1.2 billion of general fund, and a significant portion of tobacco tax. So those are also considered state funds, though they are not general fund. They're raised from taxing tobacco sales.
I was under the impression that most of the tobacco tax revenue is going for long-term debt payment now. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chair and members,
that's the settlement, isn't it? That's the global settlement.
Yes, the master settlement agreement, much of that is going for debt repayment, but the tobacco tax, most of it goes into the health plan. The governor's recommended budget cut $211.5 million total funds, about $77.6 million general fund, from the expected 2005-07 costs. We used to call that expected cost the current service level, and I'll probably have my tongue removed.
In this committee, that's what it is called.
The current service
level. Yeah, that is what it is. That's what it's understood in all the other states. That's what it's understood by those that are not looking for political spin. So CSL, current service level, is what I'd like to refer to it as in this subcommittee, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What are the other committees referring to it as?
essential service level.
Budget level.
Essential budget level.
Essential.
In other words, we want to fund essential services first, and so therefore current service levels become essential service levels, as if the term change could make a difference. Senator Wessel.
Good call, Mr. Chair.
Good call. As
Very
well.
Good call, because CSL is a tool. It's not a mandate. It's
That's right.
Good
it's,
call.
That's
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and members, again, current service level is built in a budget process. The budget and management division analysts, whom you met earlier, will essentially follow a particular set of instructions and work with the agencies to try and arrive at an estimate for what current programs cost into the next biennium. So typically when we talk about reductions made, we're talking about reductions made to existing programs or to that estimate of what current services will cost in the next biennium. I've listed several, the Oregon Health Plan reductions that coincide with seniors and people with disabilities reductions, and we'll talk about those in a moment. The point here is that there is a lot of interconnectedness between senior programs, Medicaid long-term care, and the fact that those folks are also on the Oregon Health Plan.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to understand the current service level and what we're talking about.
Sure.
Just hypothetically, if you had a $100 million budget and the proposed was $115 million, so the $115 million would be the current service level. So if you said in the governor's recommended budget he was recommending 105, you'd be talking about a $10 million cut from the current service level.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, that's right. That's right. Okay. In your example, the 250 or the 115 would be arrived at looking at the inflation, general inflation, or in some instances, medical inflation. It would be looking at caseload growth. It would be phasing out programs that were possibly ended by the legislature in the prior biennium and adding programs that were initiated by the legislature. Phase-ins and phase-outs of programs, that's the budgetary parlance for that. And then arriving at an amount, in your example, again, $115 million. And if the governor had made a $10 million cut to that estimate of what current services were going to cost in the next biennium, then you'd see a number of $10 million. That's the cut. That's right.
May I follow up? Just as we go along and make this clear to I guess in my language, I'd call it the public speak, so that for those who are watching and for those that are interested in the process, this conversation and this type of math becomes confusing, because on the other side you have people sitting there in my example saying you got a $5 million increase in your budget, and you have other people sitting on the other side saying you got a $10 million reduction. And so I want to be careful as we go through this process for the benefit of the public who is not sitting here and used to hearing current service level versus they got a net increase in the amount of dollars, that we are careful to explain that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it is very confusing to the general public. They say, well, you've got $1 billion more than you had before. How can you say you have a $500 million shortfall? And so current service level is what it would take to maintain business as it was without major, without new programs, new plans, just through all of the increases that are inherent with society, and that increase is more than the increase in revenues that we have, which brings us to further cuts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I think that's a very good point, and that's kind of why I brought it up.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Great.
Anyway. Oregon Health Plan reductions that coincide with cuts that were made, again, to current service level for seniors and people with disabilities programs. The elimination of vision and dental benefits or services for certain Oregon Health Plan clients, about 125,000 persons. various reductions to provider reimbursement, hospitals, and finally, several fee-for-service efficiencies within the Oregon Health Plan. That is, can we do business more efficiently by controlling claims and other things within the Oregon Health Plan? So there's some proposed efficiencies within this governor's recommended budget as well. Other issues. Medicare Modernization Act. I would encourage each of you to read what you can about the Medicare Modernization Act. This is a major shift in federal policy that would add a prescription drug benefit to the Medicare benefit package, and how we respond to that is very important. Heretofore, what are known as dual eligibles, persons eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, have received a prescription drug benefit, but they've received it through the Medicaid program. Now that Medicare will offer a prescription drug benefit, what will that do with our costs? It's a significant issue. Healthcare cost increases. I've said still an issue. We were very concerned in the 2003 session about Oregon Health Plan cost increases. We still are, although they are not expected to be as high as they were for the current biennium, 2003-05. Always, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, approval of possible waiver changes. It takes time to implement a waiver change. It takes time for CMS to look at it. It takes time to negotiate whatever changes we wish to make to a waiver. And sometimes if your budget is built on the assumption that a waiver change will decrease cost, it's critical that that waiver be approved in a certain time frame. Otherwise, we won't achieve cost savings.
And sometimes it takes political capital to get it done.
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, absolutely.
I'd like to just follow up with this theme a little bit. If there's a need for waivers, I'm asking those that have been here a while, is that something that we need to identify and take to the co-chairs, or is Mr. Rocco already talking with the co-chairs about this and it's in the process happening? I mean, how's it going to happen?
It could come from several ways. Last session, we worked on a package, policy packages, that we knew would require the waivers. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the previous session, we did the same thing when we worked on the Oregon Health Plan. So it can come from that methodology, and then because the process is long and laborious, we usually pass a bill. And then forward on, but we're talking to the federal government in the process of what we're proposing to do mm-hmm. along the way. But it is a laborious process.
Okay, Representative Weston.
No, go ahead.
First thing you have to do is figure out the policy changes that are acceptable to the committee, the policy committees, and the governor's office. We all have to come to a very well-defined consensus as to what we want waived, what applications we want to make. And then working through the executive branch, they're pretty much the ones that shepherd this through the process. Aaron Kelly Seal, mm-hmm. Gary Weeks, Barney Spade. So it's really driven through or applied for through the executive branch.
Okay.
The key to the whole thing is do we come to that consensus? And then how long does it take the feds to respond and approve? And that's very much a back and forth process. And the point John was trying to make was that we figure the savings based on a full biennium. It is never a full biennium. I mean, if it'd be $20 million for the biennium, by the time we get done getting the real approval and then getting them implemented, another time delay, usually half the biennium's gone by, so we only accrue half of the savings.
Okay. Thank you. And we can move on.
Yeah.
It's going to be generated basically from the governor's office in in conjunction with leadership and policy committees. And I just, as I've read the governor's recommended budget, there were some assumptions in there that I just was hoping that there's progress being made on this request
Mr. Chair,
waivers.
But down here, when we're crafting the budget together, those sometimes we're putting those assumptions in there. And then later, for example, if we're looking at the Oregon Health Plan and you're talking about changing the benefit line, which we did last session when we got the from the CMS back,
mm-hmm.
they said no. So we had already had taken some action here, which then had to be changed later because they did not agree with what we had requested, and we had already made those budget assumptions, which then had to be changed. We assumed some savings.
Senator Mona Sanderson, has there been any discussion with you about having your substantive committee having dealing with waivers at all?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm cognizant of the time, and I'm going not to talk faster, but glide over some of these a little quicker. The governor's recommended budget assumes use of prior authorization for prescription drugs on our fee-for-service side. That is currently prohibited under state law and would require a statutory change. Another issue, the future role of the Oregon State Hospital and the Oregon State Hospital's forensics caseload. We've been dealing with that at least just about every emergency board. We've been hearing reports about the forensics caseload out there. Seniors and people with disabilities cluster, major programs, long-term care. Again, Medicaid, big funder of long-term care. Oregon Project Independence, and spousal pay. These are general funded only programs. Programs for persons with developmental disabilities, some of them long-term care, some of them known as support services under a Staley lawsuit settlement agreement. We'll talk about that. Federal Older Americans Act, which provides funding to area agencies on aging to implement programs for seniors. Direct financial support, the linkage with supplemental security income. And finally, this is one area that does have its own field staff. They are not in the children's, adults, and families area, but field staff who provide program support. $2.2 billion total fund budget, $729 million general fund. the governor's recommended budget cuts about $200 million in total funds, $77.6 million general fund from expected costs. These reductions include the elimination of Oregon Project Independence, the General Assistance Program, and adult foster care under Medicaid long-term care that is provided by relatives. There is rate restructuring for adult foster homes and assisted living facilities, a rate increase for adult foster homes, and a rate decrease for assisted living facilities. Capping one of the waivers, the number of people who can be admitted into the Medicaid long-term program, the home and community-based care waiver, delaying or eliminating altogether the cost of living increases for certain providers, and slowing the rate of the Staley settlement expansion for support services for persons with developmental disabilities. Seniors and people with disabilities, other issues, top page 10, home care worker costs, and as you noted earlier, Mr. Chair, changing the long-term care program for the future. How do we look ahead and rationalize this program when we are hit in 20 or even 30 years with the baby boomer generation? Finally, I've listed how to further integrate Medicaid, both acute and long-term care Medicaid, as well as Medicare. How do we pull all those together? There have been some unique specific demonstration projects, Providence Elder Place in Portland, that have done some of that, but this is a good way to go as far as I can tell, to pull acute and long-term care more closely together.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Hannah.
This is an issue of the Medicare, Medicaid buckets, mm-hmm. where, and I'm not sure where the rest of the committee is on this, but in my past work with healthcare and healthcare providing systems, I could use a crash course, aside from this committee level, of the interaction at the state level of these two payment methods and how they coincide. So if that opportunity would come forth, I would appreciate an opportunity to sit down with whomever that expert might be to give a...
All right. This is a good time for me to mention that I've already talked with Sheila Baker and John Britton about having a Human Services 101 course for myself, for Representative Hansen and Representative Hannah between 3:30 and 4:30 and 5:30 every afternoon, Monday through Thursday, and because of quorum considerations, there could be up to two of the senators involved, and so it's going to be downstairs in LFO. If you'd like to participate, I would ask Senator Westland if he would coordinate regarding the attendance of two senators, if there's those that would like to come, so that we don't end up with a quorum problem public meeting. I just want you all to know there's going to be some boning up taking place in Human Services 101, and so we'll put this on the agenda so that we can gain the knowledge that we need to participate effectively. Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left, so how would you like to go ahead?
I'll walk quickly through the next two slides. The department-wide support services is the budget structure within the Department of Human Services budget that encompasses both the department's director's office and their central administrative services functions, such as information technology, accounting, human resources functions, those kinds of things. The budget numbers are there for you. The major issues in this budget include some additional funding for replacing the Medicaid Management Information System. This is an ongoing project they've been working on the last couple biennia. This moves it forward. And then new work on a child welfare information system replacement. And then one of the things that you will see is that as the budget proposes changes in other areas, for example, in the seniors and people with disabilities or health services, that there are central costs that are included in the department-wide support services budget to reflect that. And then there is a reduction from the current service level cost of $23 million total funds, $10.5 million general fund. About half of that is in deferring computer equipment replacement and eliminating some computer system support staff, and there are other administrative cost reductions as well. On top of page 11, we get out of the Department of Human Services into other agencies, and the largest one that you will see outside of Department of Human Services in terms of general fund expenditures is the State Commission on Children and Families, and that will come before you next week. This is a commission that helps oversee and helps develop policy for the statewide system of services for children and families, including 36 local commissions. So there is technical support as well as funding that flows through the state commission to the local commissions. And then the state commission also provides funding for specific programs that have been identified by this legislature as a high priority, including Healthy Start, relief nursery programs, and that sort of thing. So you'll hear more about them next week. Basically, the governor's budget makes some reductions across programs, but basically holds them at their 2003-05 funding level, except for the transfer of juvenile crime prevention grants, which are now being administered through the Criminal Justice Commission. It moves them to the State Commission on Children and Families. So it looks like they have a budget increase, but the bulk of that increase is through the transfer of these juvenile crime prevention grants. And we'll hear more about those next week.
You've heard it in mentioning Insurance Pool Governing Board. Again, major program is the Family Health Insurance Program, FEOP, which subsidizes health insurance premiums for low-income persons. $81.5 million of total funds, $26.9 million general fund. This is up from about $15 million in the current biennium. So this is an increase above and beyond current service level in an attempt to meet maintenance of effort requirements under our Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver, Medicaid waiver. And last slide, just to again highlight some of the other agencies. These are all the LFO analyst is Deborah Manthe, whom you met earlier, and the budgets for each of them. The last two, the Board of Nursing, Board of Medical Examiners, strictly other funds. No general.
Hey, thank you very much for this overview. I have 14 acronyms that I've got listed so far, and I'm going to have these transcribed, and I will provide them to whoever wants them. As I get this list, it'll grow and grow, but I figure it'll help me to come to understand them. This information is very, very valuable, and we look forward to moving ahead now. So we're going to meet Monday, 8:30, and we'll have an informational meeting relating to Senate Bill 555. If there's no further comments, then we're adjourned.